Welcome.
Welcome.
We were dancing to the Hold music.
Did you like the Hold music?
I love the Hold music.
Fantastic. Hopefully not as good as our banter and chatter.
Hopefully not, but you never know.
You never know. You never know. We should get a rating on it. A poll. There's a useful, useful
There's
poll.
There's a useful poll.
All right, so thanks for that last session, Steve.
It was my pleasure.
So security is always one of those tough topics. You could have a really nice, well-performing TFS server. You've got your security nailed, and you know what? Sometimes it can be set and forget.
It can be.
I've got my security the way I want it, and maybe I'm not going to worry about it anymore. So that's great for your environment, not so good for practicing or studying for the exam. So I think the Brian Keller VM, the VM that Steve and I have been using, we've had some links up there a few times over the last day or two. So that's a great place to practice security. I'd encourage that over production.
Yes.
You know, prod's good for testing your own apps, but maybe security, the Keller VM's a much better choice for us. Okay. So let's switch over and have a look at what I'm going to talk about now. So I'm moving into customized Team Foundation server for team use. In this particular module, I want to talk about configuring a team build definition. I want to go through and have a look at managing build execution. So a couple of build things there. We're going to move into modifying a process template, configure a team project, apply work item customizations. We'll have a look at some work item queries in there. And then configure client connectivity to TFS. So a very, very short one down the end there.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
It's pretty straightforward. There's only two real ways to do it, to get in.
So that's what's in store for us. Okay. Configuring a team build definition. So what the study guide says for this particular module, we want to be able to set up a symbol and source server, set up custom build numbering, configure build log verbosity, set up definition properties, including test impact analysis, code analysis, automated unit testing, and architecture validation. Set up build triggers and configure the build drop location to be in a source code control or file share. All right, that sounds reasonably doable. Let's get straight into a demonstration of all of those things. Okay, here's a VM. That's a VM. Great. So I'm just going to pop into Visual Studio here. I think Visual Studio had a little break with us too. There we go, he's back. He's
still
back.
A little pause.
Pauses are good. I'm going to go into building tailspin. No, I don't think I like building tailspin. I think the build's been configured for Fabricam. Does that sound reasonable, Steve?
Yep.
Alrighty. Over into Fabricam, let's go into builds here. And I'm going to say I want to create a new build definition. So for those of you that are familiar with creating build definitions, you would have recognized much of that introduction as being pretty much walking through creating build definitions. That's pretty much it.
Yep.
So the best way to be, you know, to become familiar with that is really just to create one. So I might go in here and I might call this one. So if we look to the right, I've already got a Fabricam Fiber Nightly build. So how about we call this one Fabricam CI? And I'll even spell Fabricam correctly just because I can be like that. And then we'll put in a nice meaningful description. Down the bottom there, we can enable, pause, or disable queuing for this particular build, and there's some great explanations as to why you'd want to do those things. I can move across into my triggers. So I guess in terms of the build, I'd want to be familiar with most of these options here. Just when or in what given scenario would you choose one over the other? Now, some of them are reasonably self-evident. That's fairly straightforward. Others, just make sure you understand the usage scenarios. I guess building on something that Steve said in the last module, it's not always necessarily about knowing, you know, enough to get the answer right, although no, I'm not stating that very clearly. You don't need to necessarily know. Let's choose lab management as a good example. You don't need to know everything about lab management for, you know, concern over the questions about lab management. Sometimes you just need to know that overview to discount it as a possible answer. Now, I don't know if I said that overly clearly. I'm positive I didn't. So, you know, the question mightn't be about lab management. It could be about something related. An understanding of the overview of lab management, though, may allow you to discount that as a possible option. Remember, if you don't know the right answer straight away, the logical strategy for you is to go and rule out the ones that are definitely not the right answer. Process of elimination. So, you know, if we can rule out some of these things, a good general knowledge of these things will really help you with that approach. So let's get back to my build definition. A manual trigger basically says someone's got to right click on it and choose to queue that build. So these are good for builds that maybe also have some deploy component to them as well, or maybe builds that maybe do some extra testing that we don't set up and configure to happen in an automated or routine way. Continuous integration is my intention here, so every time a developer checks in, I'm going to fire off a build. My next one there is rolling builds. So I can say that I wish to accumulate check-ins until the prior build finishes, but don't build any more often than every X number of minutes. Now, this is particularly useful if we've got a lot of check-in activity happening and our build times are quite large. So if we've got 20 check-ins and our build's taking 2 hours, you know, basically through that sort of activity, you would never get them finished. It would just constantly be queuing. So I can say, accumulate those check-ins, but don't build any more often than maybe every 2.5 hours. I can go into my gated check-ins. And that is, we can accept check-ins only if the submitted changes merge and build successfully. Now that's nice for sort of shuffling off to the side, doing a quick build and verification process before we accept it into the shared code base. Now, I guess when gated check-ins first became available, that was probably people very enthusiastically thought, this is great. I go in here and I select this option and we'll never have a broken build again. Well, that's well and good, I guess, but it does introduce friction, okay? There's extra steps, extra workflow involved there. So the way that I normally coach a conversation around gated check-ins is to say that if you are having issues and problems with too frequent broken builds, maybe turn it on until the developers start to behave a little bit more. Give them that bit of extra friction and look after your code base at the same time. And when things start to improve, then maybe consider, you know, winding it back.
Absolutely. Okay. You can also self-inflict a gated check-in as well. So I like that. So I do that on occasion if I'm a bit worried about my code. I don't get to touch code very often anymore. Mm.
I'm the same.
Yep. So when I do, the rest of the team says, make sure you get that thing through with gated check-in before we're going to allow you to check it in. So
I'm just surprised I haven't taken
gated check-in.
If I was on the team, I would have taken your check-in rights away, actually.
I'm surprised they haven't.
All right, so the next option we've got down there is to schedule the build. I can go in there and say that I wish to schedule a build. I can choose the days of the week there. I can choose the particular time that I want to trigger that build. And I can go in there and say to build even if nothing has changed. Now, the option there about building even if nothing's changed, it's still a good opportunity then to grab information during the build process and push it into the warehouse for just keeping that regular cadence of our reports going. Okay, so that's one of the reasons that I'll often choose to do that build even if nothing has changed. I step down to my source settings there. And this is where I get to choose exactly what source is going to be pulled down. And you'll see here, and this is something that normally worries me. Anytime I see that we're going in and we've got an active mapping from the root of a project folder, that's normally cause for concern. Because typically, particularly if you've set up for branching, you'll often have subfolders in here. And there'll be subfolders there for dev, test, for any of the branches you've got. So where I see this, one of my first instincts is to have a quick look to make sure that we're not pulling down, you know, source from potentially, you know, 20 different branches just to build one. That'd be shooting yourself in the foot pretty quickly. You'll see here that they go and choose to cloak a folder, and that's a great idea. So don't try and pull down the drops folder. So don't start this build by picking up last builds for the heck of it. Not a great idea. I'm going to go down to the build defaults. And of course, it'll default to our controller. This is always really interesting, having that option of controller there, considering you can only have one controller. Anyway, it's an interesting control. I work my way down there, and I've got a choice here that says that this particular build does not output to a drop folder. Now, that's often useful for a build deploy test workflow, where I'm using one build to control the deployment and testing, but then I may want to go and use an existing build to do the compilation itself. So you can sort of chain those two builds together very, very nicely. We can copy our build output to a drop folder. That's got to be a UNC path, so I'm going to say I want to go and drop that on VSALM and FF drops for Fabric M Fiber drops. That's where I'm going to go and get my build outputs and place them. I'm going to go down and select my process now. So you do want to spend just a little bit of time in the process here. Under the required at the top there for the default template, I can go and choose the projects to build. Now, if I had a solution open at the moment, it would default to those. I can choose particular configurations to build. The interesting thing here is I can go and say, well, look, I want to build a debug release, and I can go and say that I want to go and build a release configuration at the exact same time. Normally, you'll just have one there, but just know that you can certainly build up multiple configurations at the same time. Working our way down into the basic settings here. Now under basic, the default setting here is to go looking for any assemblies there that have the word test included in the name of the assembly. And we're going to go and automatically run tests inside that assembly that have that test method attribute on the front of them. Again, let's dig in just a little bit further. And for the purpose of studying for the exam, we'd really want to drill down into each of these options. Fail build on test failure. So remember at the moment, if we get a successful compilation, but then a test fails, we call that a partial build. We could say that if any tests fail, we want to outright fail the build altogether. Okay, so you can, you know, no test, no build kind of thing. I can go down to the run settings there, and I can choose settings files if I wanted to go and do that. I can work my way down and target the test execution platform. x86 there is the default. I can go and provide test filters. And I guess while you're doing your self-study, this little panel down the bottom there can be very, very helpful for you in just getting a quick overview of what each of these settings do. Any that you're then not quite sure of, you can always go and look up a little bit more. Okay, our test run name, our test spec down the bottom, our build number format. So this was something that was called out very specifically in the preparation guide. And that is, I can go over here, and this is where that build number syntax for the build appears. I can very easily select the three ellipses button, and this is the default string that we've got. And here's a sample of what it looks like. So if this build definition was called Fabric-M CI, which it is, then this will be the first build on the 16th of May 2012. Now, if I wanted to change that, I can expand out macros here, and you'll see that there's a number of macros that are freely available for me to use. I can also go and put just simple literals in there if I wanted to do that. So I can go up here and say that, let's put AB on the end as something just... Okay, maybe that was a little bit flippant. I'll put it in the middle as my random flippant solution. Who would have thought? Did you know that? Did you know you couldn't put something on the end?
No.
No, neither did I. In hindsight, a revision, a dot number on the end does probably make a lot of sense, but nonetheless, I'll get over that pretty quickly. So by putting in the little literal, you'll see that that's changed the preview of the label down below. I'll cancel out of there. Do I want to clean the workspace? Now I've got a number of choices here. The most conservative option says that I want to go and clean everything. So basically, we want to start this build by having a completely clean slate. So pull all of the files down. Now again, it is the most conservative, but it has the greatest overhead because we're basically saying, you know, throw everything away and get every file that we're going to need. Okay, so conservative, bigger overhead. So is there somewhere in between? I can choose to say just my outputs. Okay, so it gets the build outputs and chooses to throw those away. So only the new built things are going to appear. Bless you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. down the bottom there, and then none. So that basically says work as a standard developer workspace would. So let's keep them there. Let's just treat it as any other workspace. And that would generally give us the smallest overhead in terms of going and getting new versions of files. Our logging verbosity. So if we're troubleshooting, basically, we've got the ability to go from minimal to normal, up to detailed and up to diagnostic, which of course is going to be very verbose. So you wouldn't normally want to leave these higher levels on, and I guess that's the hint there is that they call this one diagnostic. You'd really only turn it on when you're diagnosing a particular build issue. So normal, well, normal sounds like a pretty good default. For performing code analysis, what are our choices? We can choose to go never or always, so specific on-off switches, or we can say as configured in the project itself. Okay, so the build will take its lead from the project checked into the version control system. Source and symbol servers. Do we want to index our sources? And what's the path to our symbols? So I think, Steve, was it yesterday you were having a look and showing the symbols location? We were talking about going and finding those PDBs?
Absolutely.
So a symbol server is this big fancy name for what?
A file share.
A file share, yeah. It's a bit underwhelming, isn't it?
It is.
Let's requisition this high-end server as a symbol server. I'm sure we can talk someone into that.
I'm sure we can.
So with our symbol server, I might just cheat for now, and I'm just going to go into VSALM, FF drops, and let's just create a folder called symbols. Now, your symbols files, your PDBs can get quite big, so you want to make sure you've got a little bit of capacity there. You're also going to want to make sure that this particular location is accessible easily for people that will use things like IntelliTrace, remote debugging. What was the example you were using yesterday, Steve? Remember?
I've forgotten. It was something testing, but I don't remember what it was related to.
Code coverage.
Yes.
Okay. If I remember.
Memory.
Surprising.
Nicely done.
So the symbol server is going to take care of creating those PDBs and then moving them off somewhere centrally that the tools can then go and find them. So that's fantastic. And it also takes care of making sure that, that we can match a particular PDB back to the exe or DLL that it was created from. And it does that by creating a folder, and it uses a thumbnail, a big GUID there. So if you look up the symbols folder later on, what you see are these folders with great big long GUIDs for their name. That's good. You just leave them like that. That takes care of all of the synchronization issues for us to make sure that we get the right PDB for the particular exe or DLL that we're working with. Okay. Although a little bit unusual to see a big group of folders with GUIDs for their names.
It is, very much. Very much so.
But don't panic.
Actually, you don't have to look at it manually. You just leave it there. Just point to the folder. It figures it out itself.
Set and forget.
Yep, exactly.
All right. Let's expand advanced down here now. We're getting through most of the lists. So under our agent settings, I've got the ability to go and specify a couple of things in here. The maximum execution time. Okay, so we're saying no maximum here. The maximum agent reservation wait time. We can specify a particular filter on the display name for a build agent. We can go in there and we can specify particular tags that we're looking for. Now, you'll remember earlier that I went in when I created or when I added a build agent, and I said that I can go and put specific tags on there to influence the build controller's selection of an appropriate agent. So this is where I get to say that, well, I want to go and find an agent, and that agent's got to have, .NET 3.0 as a tag. So it's going to go and look for an agent specifically that is tagged that way. Okay. For now, I'll just exit out of there.
Those are important because those tags you mentioned earlier when you were configuring the build agents, mm-hmm. That's that linkage that you were talking about.
Yep. All right. So analyze test impact. So if you want to do test impact analysis, that's a true. Do you want to associate change sets and work items with this particular build? So that's entirely up to you if you wanted to do that. Create a work item on failure, true or false. Do you want to disable tests here? So if I was doing a build deploy test workflow, I might consider disabling my tests for the build that does the actual compilation step. I may then choose to go and deploy it as part of that build deploy test workflow, And then I want to run the tests after it's been deployed. Okay, so I've got some choices there. So that's an example of when perhaps we may want to be able to cancel some of those, or sorry, to not run or disable some tests. In terms of getting a particular version, so by default, we would normally just do a get latest. But you've got other choices in here. I can go in there and say, I want a particular labeled version. I want a particular change set version. So I think they give an example here. So I can say that instead of doing a get latest, I want to go and do a get at change set 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 4, 5. You can simply specify those. Do you want to label your sources? There are some MS build arguments. So I can choose to pass arguments across here. So I can do things like specify a slash P. I remember back with 2010 when by default it didn't use multi-cores. So 2010 was always a single threaded build experience. Yep. So you could pass an argument here that would tell it to go and use multiple threads of execution. Okay, so you've got some fine tuning and some tweaking there that you can pass through to the MS build arguments.
And there's actually a big load of those that you can pass in.
Oh, there's heaps.
Just heaps. For instance, if you want to you can pass in a bunch of those, mm-hmm. For instance, to deploy automatically to a particular website.
Great example.
You need something deployed to that website, mm-hmm. like the, what are the Microsoft extensions for website deployment? I don't know. It's something that you'd need to deploy out to the website. Mm-hmm. You pass in this whole string of parameters, and all of a sudden, poof! Your website's deployed as part of the build process without hardware any work. it's pretty slick.
Poof, like magic. That's really good.
Poof. Just like magic.
You guys need a sound effects board up the back there, or you just need to employ him to come back.
It's just recordings after.
All right, so you see here that we've got MS Build Multiproc, so they've called that one out specifically. And now you'll see the default there is true. We can also, of course, set that back to false if we need to. True's a great default, and if you've got problems, then you can always wind it back. But let's get the best performance we can. The build platform, we can choose to say automatically detect that, or I can bind it. Do I want to specify a private drop location as opposed to the public one? So I can do this for private or buddy builds. And then finally, there, solution specific build outputs. So do you want to put your build outputs into folders based on the solution names, or drop them all into the same folder? Just a little flag there you can choose. So, Steve, of all of those options there, how many of those would you really think you'd want to commit to memory?
Woof, not many. There's a few. I like to know how to run the automated tests, let them know that you know, you pass in a DLL there or some names. I like to know things like the items to build, where those things go, the source and symbol server settings. I think that's important because you need to know what it does, but also how to get there. And the fact that you just need index sources set to true, I think that's good. The tag filters, mm-hmm. I think that's important. That just because it's that tie between those two. It's mentioned several times in the preparation guide. Mm-hmm. And of those, I think that kind of wraps up that whole thing.
Excellent.
Those are the areas I'd like to do. Gated check-in, I think, is important.
Okay.
As well.
So we'd probably suggest there that you'd go and turn on some gated check-in. Just get some experience with that. Just definitely understand what the workflow is, what the screens look like.
Yep.
And I suppose we've provided a bit of the bigger picture there around what that gated check-in has to offer, what the problem domain might look like. Okay. I'll continue down through defining this particular build definition. And the next choice we've got there is our retention policy. So particularly if you think about, you know, a reasonably busy team, a reasonable size team, with continuous integration may generate 50, 60, heck, 100 builds a day. Or 800 builds a day in Steve's environment.
You should see how many Microsoft produces. They move 17 terabytes of data every night as part of just the Visual Studio build.
That's amazing, isn't
it? That's what I heard. I was so impressed. It's a lot of data.
Some really inefficient code. Who knows? All right.
I'm just thinking you might be getting a call from William on that.
I could be. All right. So in terms of our retention policy, this is something that with all of these builds taking place, we want to make sure that we simply don't fill up all of the hardware resources on our build agents. So specifying your retention policy is it's that automated cleanup. So for triggered and manual builds, I can choose that if we physically stop that build, I can say, just keep the latest one. If it's a failed build, how many would you like to keep? If it's a partially succeeded build, in other words, it's typically compiled, but some of our tests have failed. Again, let's just keep the last 7 as an arbitrary number. And if the build succeeds, would you go high or low on a build succeed?
I'd go high.
Ah, wrong. So we're going to go down to a...
What?
I usually go low on a build succeed.
Really?
If the build succeeds, why are you going to keep it on the build server? We don't store on the build server. I was trying to push you, press you, by the way.
Boy, you sure did. I actually go high on those.
You do?
I usually enter like 500. So every single one of those just laid on out.
Why?
I actually don't know. I've never really go back to them on the build server.
So let's talk
That's
about it.
That's a really good point.
If a build fails, what are you going to do?
Throw it away.
You're going to go fix it. You want to troubleshoot it.
Yeah, but it's
you
only
want to be able to get to the You want to be able to get to the drop location. Can someone just mute his mic? And get his pants back. So we want to be able to troubleshoot these things. If a build fails, I want to keep it around while I've got time to get into that drop location, to look at the logs, to find out what's going on. Now, if I'm in the middle of that and 3 people check in and it fires some builds and suddenly, boom, the one I'm trying to troubleshoot's disappeared, I'm not a happy camper.
Yeah, but it's that particular build definition that goes away. It's per build definition. So if another one comes in that's also failed, I don't know.
No,
I don't know.
Now, if a build succeeds...
Keep 3 or 4 of those around at most. Successful builds, you may want to roll back at some point in time.
But
you may want to reach
store them on a build
them.
Server. You can always go back and get historically any previous version of the code and have
what?
That built.
No. We disagree. We disagree. You can't go back and build
I'll
something.
Let you be wrong. It's all right.
That's probably, well, I'll just sit here because I can type like a really long response.
Oh, that's unfair.
Evil.
Okay. So this is kill the mic and this is kill the keyboard. All right. So with our private builds, oh, look. It's kept low. What can I say? So with our private builds here, you can also set independent values, including succeeded, down to low. And that's all I wanted to say now. I've got my way. That's build retention. Anyway, so that was very clearly spoken about in that exam preparation guide. And again, it's really just designed there to limit the amount of things that happen on that build server. It's for many of my customers... Their builds aren't actually that big. Okay, so if we've got an application, we go ahead and we compile the application. If it's a website, how big's the footprint of that normally? So we've got our published website there. We've got a bunch of web pages. We've got some assemblies there as well. I mean, it could be a fairly big web application, but only have a footprint of a couple of hundred meg. Okay, it doesn't need to be very, very big. So some of the things that I do, particularly with physical build servers, is to just go and get like a 64 gig SSD. I mean, they're a dime a dozen almost these days. So you put in a 64 gig SSD and your disk IO operations per second go from... Actually, so Steve, getting back to the low number up there, related to that, what's the concurrent disk IO operations on, say, a 7200 RPM SATA drive?
I have no idea, but
about
I know
175?
I have no idea. But I did know when I slid that out and slid in an SSD, my boot time went from like 45 seconds to 7. So,
oh, yeah. So concurrent disk IO operations on, say, just a modern generation SSD would jump up to the vicinity of, from 175 up to 75,000. Or more. I mean, it's a staggering number. So, even a small SSD in a physical build server can make some extraordinary differences to the performance of that build.
No kidding.
Yeah. And people say, well, look, but it's not going to last very long. Well, the life of an SSD is still 10 years or more. It's all right. You can afford to burn a few of them out.
You sure can.
If you really want to.
Especially at the prices today for a 64 gig one.
Oh, no, but you can't. Because you like to keep all of your builds there, Steve. So you're going to have to go and buy these terabyte SSDs.
Yes.
All right. Well, you get cantankerous in the middle of the week, Steve. So that's our build definition. So I'm going to go ahead and save that build definition now. And it's going to say, no, you're not, because up here in process, I didn't say build anything because I haven't got anything open. And you know what? I'm not going to. Because now I'm cranky.
I thought I was the one that was cranky.
All right. Let's see. Did I cover off? I'm feeling pretty good about those things. So let's have a look at some of those resources there. So as Steve and I have been doing all day, there's a list of topics that we've just walked through, and here's some great links into the MSDN library that allows you to go in and find out more information about them. So they really do cover off, you know, the preparation guide covers most things that we've had a look at in creating that build definition. All right, managing build execution. So stepping into the next topic there. So slightly different here. We want to have a look at queuing a build with parameters. Some of the workspaces with gated check-ins, customizing build qualities, and a cleanup of build. So I think I've covered off the retention policies, even though we've disagreed. The retention policies are looking pretty good there. So let's have a look at just a couple of those other things. Okay, so I'm not going to use the build I created. I'll go and use the Fabricam Fiber Nightly build. So if I want to go and queue that build, I can say that I want to queue the build. And most of the time, I guess you probably just simply go and say queue. You'll probably just be using the defaults that you've already specified. But let's just take a moment and see what other choices are available to us. So I can go and change the drop folder location if I wanted to do that as a one-off. So instead of dropping into a central location where all of our drops go, I can say, well, look, you know what? I've got a shared folder on my machine. Go and do the builds, but put the outputs down here because I just want to do some further testing on the compiled sources, please. If we work our way back up there, I can go in there and I can say use the latest with a shelf set. Okay, so buddy builds. I can work up here, and I guess the particular thing mentioned in the exam preparation guide was being able to pass parameters across there. And all I wanted to call out was you've got access to quite a few of those options at the time you queue the build. So over here, we set what we wanted the logical defaults to be, but every time you go into queue one, you've got the chance to go in here and tweak some of those things. Okay, so the build might call for a get latest. I can come in here, and on this particular one, I want to go and get change set 1, 2, 3 and bring that one down, please. Or I can specify a certain label. Or
I love that. Use L and specify a label, yeah. D, throw in a date.
That's it.
Just pull in anything there.
Okay, so that's queuing a particular build and passing parameters at the time. We talked about the retention policy. We talked about cloaking and folders. I didn't want to do the gated check-in. What was the fourth one, Steve? Build qualities.
Yes.
All right. So if I go in and have a look, let's say that the Fabricam Fiber build, I'm just going to clear that filter so we've got a couple to look at. We want to specify a build quality, and you can see there's already one specified here. Let's imagine for a moment that this build listed at the top has just completed. I can open it up, and I can have a look at the information shown here. I can look through there and think, well, you know what, that's actually not too bad. I'm pretty happy with it. I can work my way up the top here, and here's where we specify our build quality. Now, it's really just a flag. I can go and say that, well, as a developer, I'm pretty happy with this. I like what I see there. So I can go and say that this is perhaps now ready for an initial test. For those of you that were watching yesterday, this is where, for example, when Steve was going in and assigning a build in Microsoft Test Manager, he had the opportunity of going in and setting up filters to try and get rid of some of the noise. So instead of seeing all of those builds here and letting a tester see them all, we can say, well, look, you know, there's a bunch there that I just don't need the testers to see. I don't want them to use it. We're not ready for them to do it. And if they're going to go and start testing on one of these, they're really largely wasting their time. I'd much rather control that by going over here, switching that across to, you know, ready for initial test, and then allowing them to filter on those things.
Yep.
Okay. And you'll see, based on the other things that we have there, we can actually keep incrementing or changing that build quality as that particular build goes out through our quality gates.
Absolutely. In fact, there's tools that you can use that as you progress, they kick off deployments.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes as well. It's one way to do it. I think there are nicer tools too.
All right. So let's jump back out of that one. So that's the links to additional resources to help you with that particular topic of build execution. Now we're going to, you know, dive out of there for a moment, and we're going to have a look at process templates. Now we want to have a look at uploading and downloading process templates, troubleshooting template errors. It's fairly safe to assume I'm going to make a few of those. So you're going to see that troubleshooting firsthand, and customizing some functional areas. So Steve, from your experience, process template customization, it comes up a few times in the exam preparation guide. So how much effort would you put into prepping for template customization?
A moderate amount of effort. I think it's something that's worth understanding. I think it's also something that happens quite regularly with people who are running a TFS server. So if you're administering a TFS server, you probably run into these customizations, either through upgrading to the latest versions, up to 2010, you had to do a lot yourself, or through just customizations on your own. So I would probably spend a moderate amount of time here.
Okay, thanks for that. All right, so let's go in and have a look at a couple of these things specifically. In terms of the template customization process, a very, very high level walkthrough. Download the process template that you're either currently using or that most closely matches what you will be using. There's no such thing as a blank template. You've really got to start with one of the out-of-the-box ones and then customize that to your needs. So grab one of the out-of-the-box Microsoft templates. Step one, rename it. Okay? You want to put a unique name there so that any future updates or things don't overwrite some of your changes, or worse, other team members may assume that it is the out-of-the-box one. If you're going to change it, just rename it. It's not a hard thing. Make a few small changes at a time, verifying those changes as you go. Okay, just little incremental changes. Much better than going and making this enormous number of changes, and then you upload it and it breaks. Then you've got to try and troubleshoot it, and then you upload it and it breaks. Just do it as a nice incremental approach. And I think that's going to be a much better strategy for getting those customizations to work for you. Upload to a non-production server to test. Yet we know that prod's the best place to test. They've got the fastest computers, the fastest feedback from the user base. You know, there's some definite advantage of doing it in prod. But don't do that. And there are certain things that you can't easily undo. So, you know, I would say even just a nice little VM that we could simply revert would be a really nice choice for testing those process templates. And then really, let's be a little bit hyper-paranoid here. We could go so far as to even potentially snapshot or clone our production TFS server and do the customizations on an actual clone of production, perhaps.
I love that idea. I think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. If you do clone your server, make sure you run change server ID. You must run, is it TFS config change server ID? I don't know where that is, but change server ID is absolutely required. If you clone a TFS server and don't run change server ID, what will happen is that if you attach to this, your cloned version, and you're executing commands here, they'll execute on both your servers. Kind of stinks.
A bit dangerous.
Yeah.
Especially because we're trying to recommend or suggest this for good, healthy, conservative reasons.
Exactly. And then you get in, you think you're comfy, and you're like, TFS delete project. Boom! Yep.
And why do you think I'm suggesting doing it on a production server? Or, sorry, a clone of production?
It's identical.
Yeah.
So as close as you can get.
If you're going to be tripped up with any data that you've got or any existing customizations or, you know, the final test should be as close to production as you can before we sign off and move it into that last step.
Yep, agreed.
And again, remember, you can't often easily undo. There's no push that template change across, modify the cube and go, whoops, control Z.
Exactly.
It doesn't work.
I would recommend, however, that you do put all of your process changes inside a version control. So you can go back and reapply a process template. Once again, like you mentioned, once you've run all of those cube updates, the stuff's going to be in the cube. You have to destroy them and reprocess them if you have gone that far.
Mm-hmm. All right. Create a new team project to test your template. So pretty much that's the next thing you're going to need to do. So you've done your customizations, and then logically the next thing will be to create a new team project from it. And then, you know, work your way through it and see that the customizations that you've requested, accepted, or sorry, planned, behave the way that you expected. All right. And then verify the changes that you've made are correct. So let's go ahead and look at a demonstration of some of these things. So starting with downloading the template, I'll show you that. We'll have a look at a rename. And here we are. So step one, I'm going to go up to the team option. I'm going to go to Team Project Collection Settings because our process templates are at the collection level. I'm going into Process Template Manager. Now choose the one closest to what you want to use. I'll go ahead and say download, and for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to drop that in the root of the C drive. So that's pulled the active template out of TFS or out of that TPC and placed it onto the C drive where I've requested it. And sure enough, MSF for Agile Software Development 6.2. So as Steve recommended just a moment ago, a process template is a big bunch of files and folders.
Yep.
Is there a great place we can store that, Steve?
Version control!
Version control!
Did I steal your thunder again on that?
Of course.
Man.
It's a great place. The number of times that I've gone back to a customer and they've said, oh, look, we've just updated to 2012. Can you just, there's a lot of changes that we made, but we want these new changes as well. So can you get the current template and re-implement the changes that are already there? Okay, sure. What's already there? I don't know. You didn't document it? No. So I end up having to go there and doing diffs to come up with a list of all of the changes they're currently using to reapply them in the new template. And it's excruciatingly painful, particularly if perhaps they've done it using one of the power tools where the order of the elements can radically be changed. So then diffing tools just don't handle that overly well. So going and dropping these things into version control, I think, is a great idea. So the first recommendation that we had there was to look at a rename. So I'm going to go and open that file. So again, I'll go and find where I placed it under the C drive. Let's go and find processTemplate.xml, and I'll go ahead and open it. Now, you can think of this particular file as being the, the table of contents, the index. I'll go up here and rename it by simply giving it a new name. And I might just call it Enhanced ALM Agile Process. That's good enough. And then I'll provide a nice description there. Use this for all of our new team projects. I'll leave the typos in as a sign of authenticity. I'll say that as a major and a minor. And you'll see that unlike previous releases of TFS, there's also a unique ID here, a little GUID. So I'm going to go up to my tools. I'll go and say create GUID. I'll find the one that looks most similar, which I think is the registry format. Drop that GUID into the clipboard. Go ahead and put the new GUID into here, dropping off those curly braces like that. And then very rarely do I find that you do much more customization in this file. The primary thing that we were most concerned with there is just simply the rename. So I'm going to go ahead and save that. And by simply renaming it, I've now got the opportunity to go back into Team, Collection Settings, Process Template Manager, and I can go and upload my, in brackets, new process template. And there it is, with my nice typo included description. Now, of course, there's no real customization there. That's just blatant plagiarism of Microsoft's original template. So what's the next step for us? So now that we've got that in place, I'm just going to jump back out of there. Were there some specifics? Let me just try it back here. There were no specifics there. So we've done the rename. Coming up in a moment, they're going to talk about some of the specifics in terms of new fields and things. So for now, I just want to go through the process of pulling the template down, doing the rename, pushing the template back up. Now, if there had been an error, at the point in time when I did the re-import or the upload of that process template, it is doing a validation process. So if I've made a typo, if I've done something a little bit crazy in there, then there is this level of checking that goes on to make sure that, you know, that I haven't done anything too bad. Now, you can still get them uploaded and still have mistakes in them that won't manifest themselves until you create a new team project. Okay, so there's a couple of levels of checks there. What I have found, though, is if you do make some mistakes, for the most part, the errors seem to be very descriptive. They tend to pinpoint those mistakes for you pretty quickly. Okay, so back down here. So some resources to get you started on those things. In terms of those functional areas, it does go in and talk a lot more about changes to SSRS, SharePoint, build definitions. There's a great little resource there on the MSDN library. Okay, we're coming back to process template customization in just a moment. So the study guide says we should take a little wander away for a moment, away from template customization, and we should have a look at configuring a team project. And then we're going to go back to template customization. Must have been an alphabetical sort.
I have no idea.
That's okay. We can wander to the wilderness and back again.
Exactly.
Going and defining areas and iterations. The guide says we should be familiar with that. Now, Steve, did you cover that enough when you went up to the little administration? Did you create an area or an iteration?
I didn't really create it.
I should show that again then.
You should, and I think actually in this one, you also should show it not just creating it, but how to create default ones in the process template.
Okay.
There's a little piece of that in there as well.
Okay, so maybe I've got the context wrong for this section.
No, I don't think so. It's probably worth showing how to do it, but then how to do it inside of the process template is probably a good thing.
It's a good idea. How to manage users through default security groups. That was something that Steve has already shown us. But I guess if the context is around the template customization, I can have a look at some security groups within the template. We can have a look at perhaps how we can create some additional groups if there's a value add in doing that. Managing the project portal settings and some project level alerts. I think Steve's shown those alerts, and project level alerts isn't a template thing. No. I think you've done the alerts there reasonably well.
Yeah, I think so.
So let's go ahead and have a look at the areas and iterations, and then I'll jump back into the process template editing and see how we can do the same thing there. So back into Fabricam Fiber, I'm going to choose, there's a couple of ways of getting here. So if I go into my settings and I go and choose work item areas or iterations, that's going to take me to a certain location. Alternatively, I can go back into my web access. And when I'm having a look at my web access, I can go up here into this little cog in the top right-hand corner to take me into the administration page. And sure enough, there's the areas and iteration tabs across the top. Now, the alternate way that I showed you that does the exact same thing. If I go to my iterations, I can go and create additional iterations. I can say I want a new child of Fabricam Fiber. Now, this particular child I'm going to call release 2, typo included. And I'll save that. And then I can build up a nice hierarchy of iterations underneath release 2. And this is a personal preference. Steve, do you have an opinion on that? Would the next sprint, would you call it 1 or sprint 7?
Oh, that's tough. I think it's team contextual at that particular moment in time.
It is.
But you were the very first Scrum certified Scrum.org trainer in Australia.
I was.
I would most likely defer to your experience in this case.
Fantastic. What were they doing in Kenman? Just kidding. No. Why did I bring that up? I sense another soapbox. So I'm going to go and create a new child there. And I'm going to call this one hang on. Can I sit on the fence there? 7 and 1? Oh, okay, that's just cheating. And I can choose to go and specify some dates in there as well. And I'll just, that's a bad example. I shouldn't just randomize dates. That doesn't make sense. Okay, so building out those iterations is fairly straightforward. And that's what we've been doing with previous versions. The only difference now in 2012 is, of course, that we've got these date ranges. If I go up to my areas, then again, in the exact same way as I've done previously, I can choose to go in here and say, I want to create another area, please. Now, remember, areas has an implication with teams now. So just keep that in the back of your mind. But historically, I might have had an area called Web UX for the web user experience. Okay, and I can build those out fairly easily. So let's apply that same thing to template customization. If I go in and have a look at my process template, you'll see in here that I've got a folder called classification. And let me remember if that is the one I want. Yes, it is. And in fact, I'm going to open up classification inside Visual Studio so we get some nice color highlighting. So into it, classifications, go ahead and open up that with the XML editor. So when we use this template to create a new team project, you'll see that it's going to create 3 iterations out of the box, and it's going to name those iteration 1, 2, and 3. Now, if I don't want to create those second and third iterations every time, I can simply remove them. If I want to use different names there, I can simply go and place other names. I can also nest those if I wanted to. We work our way down to areas, and there are no default areas being created with this template, but I've got the ability to do that. I can go in there and define a number of areas in there. Oops, and there's some links to more information about those things. Now, I've still got some more work to do back with the process template customization, so still more to come there. In terms of applying those work item customizations, the study guide says we should be familiar with adding a new work item type. We should be able to customize field definitions. Now, I'll probably call that one out straight away as being something that is a very common thing to do. And because of the high value that can be achieved there, I'd say that'd be very, very, well, examinable, okay? Certainly if I was a question writer on the exam, I'd want to make sure that people could add those fields. There's some good value to be had.
Sure.
Okay. We can have a look at customizing the form layout and our workflows, displaying some of these new fields on the forms. And in terms of the layout, where I want to put them, the workflows, do I want to add some extra states in there? Or deal with some transitions. And then finally, customizing global lists, link types, and categories. And I'll probably also call out maybe a couple of new configuration files. And I'll only call those out because they're brand new in 2012, which makes it, makes them prime contenders for an exam question, in my opinion. When it comes time to adding a new field, well, the simplest approach that I've found is to create a new field, I'll go in and find a field of a similar type, simply copy and paste it, and then edit the values. I've been doing that for a long time. Looking at the syntax itself, you can see the syntax is laid out there, and one of the MSDN links that I've provided for you also takes you in and describes what each of those things are. Again, I'd want to be quite familiar with the most common ones. So, for example, I've called out a few of the different data types for the fields that we can add, date, time, double. What's the difference between HTML, plain text, and string, in terms of size and other rich information you can put in them? I'd also call out the reportable attribute. So when you specify a field, you can also choose to assign it a reportable attribute. I know there's a lot of text on the screen there. Probably too much for a slide for sure.
But it makes for good reference when you pull this down to read it, study for the exam.
Absolutely. And I've also included an MSDN link there that takes you to this exact same content with some good context around it. So I'd probably want to be well aware. Let me just toggle between these two slides. I'd really want to know the different data types, you know, the common ones there. And there's really only none and three other choices. So I'd probably want to know when to choose detail over dimension and measure. I think that's probably a bit of a value add and probably a little obscure. So I'll call that out. So let's go back up. I just want to double check here. So what I'm going to do in the demonstration, I'm just going to double check the study guide here. Let's go and add a new work item type. I think that's a good idea. Let's add a field. Let's add a new state in there as well. I think that's something that'll be well worth having a look at. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back into the template here. I'm going to go into work item tracking. So this is where you spend a lot of your time. I'm going to go and have a look at what I'll call the table of contents. With our process templates, you know, it's a very common thing here to find you've got folders containing content, and then you've got like a contents or an index file sitting out here at the root. So let's go and open up that work items file. So what you see here, it goes in and pulls in our link types. And then down here, it goes and lists out each of the different work item types. It also then goes further down and lists the different work item queries. So I can go and add a new type up here. I could then go and add one or more queries for the new type that I've added. Down the bottom in 2012, you'll see for our process configuration, there's also two new files that haven't been there before. So I'm going to go into my type definitions, and instead of just bug, I'm going to simply create a quick copy of that. And instead of bug, I'm going to call it a big bug.
Ooh,
that's pretty scary straight away. It's a big bug.
So
I'm going to go to my index file. And one of the first things I'm going to do is I'm going to simply tell the index to go looking, not bug, big bug. I'm going to tell the index to go looking for that work item type definition for me. I'll go ahead and save the index file now. And let's go and open up big bug. So I'm just going to shrink a couple of things down here. So if I zoom in there, what you'll see there is that a work item type definition file basically breaks into three regions. We have all of our fields at the top. We then have the workflow, that's the states and transitions, and then the form, how things are displayed and shown. So I'm going to go ahead and open up fields to start with. And having a little bit of a look there. Okay, so a bunch of fields. I might go and find a string. There we go. So title's a good example. I'm going to copy and paste that. Here's a truly novel idea. What's the novelty here, Steve? Putting comments in. I'd probably put more than customization starts, but that's okay.
I think this is a wonderful idea to comment your process templates here. One quick note is that when you upload this process template, but then you pull it down with the WIT admin export work item type, it comes down without the comments again.
Yeah.
Arr!
But checking this in and keeping the history there in our source control,
indeed.
I think that's still worthwhile. Still
another
worth
reason to check it in.
I've created a field here. I'm going to give it the name bug reporter. And in terms of the reference name, well, this is just to make it unique. So I like to pop in with, you know, a company name. That's usually fairly unique. Then I'll go in there and I'll say .agile. And then I'll go in and put the field name itself. So that's really the uniqueness that's going to be stored behind the scenes for me. And then a friendly name. It's going to be a string type. And remember, in terms of the reportable attribute, I showed you a slide a moment ago that shows us the options of none, and then measure dimension and detail. You know what? And if you're not sure, you can leave it out. And you can always come back and add it in. But if you put it in and get it wrong, it's already now going to be sent out to the OLAP cube. And once it's there, it's pretty much locked in. The help text, if they hover over it, what should they see? The name of the person that originally reported this bug. And I'm going to take out the required field. It's not a required field in my example. So again, simply gone in there and added a field. I'll go and close those fields now. And if I want to have a look at the workflow, here's my active state, my resolved state, and the closed state at the end. Never really been a big fan of the first state being active in the Agile template. So I'm going to simply copy that. And as a bug, I'm going to create a new state called reported. My intention is that that's going to be a state prior to it being marked active. So like a triaging state, if that makes any sense. I can choose to go and deal with some fields here. So all this is doing is grabbing a bunch of those fields and just emptying them out. Now, we're not going to have any transitions that will allow you to go back to reported. So probably a little redundant there. Okay, so I'm going to move past my states now. In fact, let's just shrink that down. And here are my transitions. From blank to active, that's the default transition. From active to resolved. Okay. From resolved back to active. So a heap of states there. The one I'm most interested in is I'm just going to, for simplicity's sake, just going to copy that initial transition, and I'm going to say we go from blank to reported, and then I can go from reported to active. And what I'd want to do there is I'd go and specify some more logical reasons to put in here, but for now I just wanted to create that new state and transition. And then the final thing to do is we go down to our form section. And the form section is how it is visually displayed. Hey, Frank, how are you, mate?
Hola.
Hola. Do you like the way that he was quiet as a mouse coming in there so no one would notice?
I know.
And it just didn't work, did it, mate?
Clearly.
All right, so we've gone in
and
there.
And I have a series of some great questions.
Really?
I do. Some great questions as you get there.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop this field in so we can see it. Then how about I go and import that into the team project, into the collection, create a team project, see how it works, and that's a great time for us to do some questions.
All right.
All right. So whereabouts should I plonk the original bug reporter? Looking, status classification. It'd be really nice if this was a nice visual form designer. It's not. It's declarative XML. So we'll see here that we've got a column that's, you know, the full width of the container. We see assigned to. Underneath that, we have state and reason, resolved reason. Then we divide things up into, we've got thirds here. So that's got four things in the left third, three things in the right third, and only two things there. So I think there'd be a nice little gap in my form just there. Or it's going to be good enough for a quick demonstration, I'm sure. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'll just sneak down here, grab a bit of code from there, probably not a great one to pick. And I'm going to drop in. Now, what is the field name? So this is the enhance-alm.agile.bugreporter was the full name of the field. Use the field control, so that's going to map back to a text box in this one. Our label is going to be bug reporter, and I'd like that label to appear on the left. Now, in this example, it's not a number format, it's not a numeric field, And I'm not going to specify a maximum length, and I don't really mind having any empty text there. So there's a few different changes there. That'll do me for now. I'm going to go ahead and save my new big bug. Close out of there. And I guess let's give that a test. So I'm going to go up to Team. I'm going to go into Collection Settings, Process Template Manager. I'll go and choose to upload. Select that folder, override the previous one. And as I fully expected and anticipated, Steve, I'm going to show you troubleshooting.
You mentioned that earlier. Very beginning of the day, you mentioned that you would be attacking troubleshooting.
I was confident in my inability to hand edit XML reliably, and it's going to be case sensitivity. You wait and see.
It could very well be. Hey, and by the way, is there a visual way to edit this stuff?
For the purpose of the exam, no, Steve, there's not.
Ouch.
While I look at this, you can give the second answer, too.
So, Erica, I wanted to let you know that there is a need to know some of the XML. You're not going to be able to get by with just the process template editor. However, I do love the process template editor. It's an easy way to make some of those changes right on the server. Little scary there, but you can also do it offline in version control as well. So, Erica, I'm with you. I can feel your pain, but you do need to know a little bit of that XML. It's mostly some of the really key elements. I'd recommend using the process template editor to make some changes, and then that little button that says Show XML popping up and looking at that XML. Are you still going on the fix?
No. If you look at my screen now, let's have a look at all that was. So I named the file Big Bug, but let's have a look up the top here. My width item type is still called bug, and it's saying you can't have two things called bug. You know what? It's probably right. I need to really concede its point. So I'll go ahead and save that, pop across to Team, go into Collection Settings, go into the Template Manager, and let's click on Upload. What do you reckon? It's going to work, Steve?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. All righty, here we go. Ooh, it worked.
Nicely done.
Okay, so we're feeling reasonably confident. We won't really know until I say New Team Project. I'll say Template Test 1. Strange how many of my TFS servers tend to have projects like that. I'll go and choose my process template from the list, and I'll just click on Finish there, and let's actually see if it's going to go through that. So there's plenty more things I can do there. I can go and save some work item queries. We've still got to cover off some queries. That might be something I might even get you to do that demo, Steve, and create a couple of queries through the UI.
Okay, I'll happily do some work item queries. Love to do that.
Interesting.
Love to get in and do some. Uploaded successfully, but version control failed.
The clock.
I go down and set your clock. No, this happens. Just go and set your clock forward a couple hours. In fact, set it forward a day if you would. I change date and time settings. That one.
One above it.
Yep. And bump that to the 17th. And okay. Close and run that one more time. So what happens is TFS is very, very particular. If you check in a work item or source, let's say a work item, and you check it in on midnight or at 1 a.m. on May 10th, and then you set your clock back 10 minutes earlier, and you do another check-in, boom, it will fail. It'll kill and you'll get that response. So what we're using with the Brian Keller machine is we've opened it up, we've done some work, and then we rebooted it. And as soon as you reboot the machine, it sets the clock back. That's part of the thing with Brian Keller's machine.
So we can blame... what I heard there was we blame Brian.
That's exactly right. This is fully Brian's fault.
All right. Well, let's see if that's the case. It's looking much better already, though.
And while that... never mind.
There we go. I'll close that. Close out of that. So over here, if we go and have a look at our new our work items area, I should be able to go and say I want to create a new... Big Bug. I'll click on Big Bug. Sure enough, here's our new little field there that I can go and put some details in. And have a look at our original or our initial state is set to reported. I can make some changes here. I might go and assign that to Julia. I'll save that.
I think Josh Wilcox put his at triage mentioned. I think that was
perfect.
Josh, not sure.
Yeah, perfect example.
Yeah. reported triage. I like that. Those both work.
Wait for that to save, and then I should be able to, with my new transition, be able to move from reported, that initial state. I can now move it across to active if I'm happy with it. Realistically, I would also have had closed in here. If my intention of that reported state was a triaging process to then either accept it or reject it, I'd want to have a second state in here to allow me to close it.
Yep, exactly. Hey, we've got some just fantastic questions.
Let's go.
Do process template customizations that you're making mm-hmm. apply retroactively to all the other team projects that you've already created with that process template?
Sadly, absolutely not. So an analogy I'll use there is imagine for a moment that we've got fax.dotx, you know, just the fax template in Microsoft Word. I can go and create, I mean, who's using faxes anymore, but ignore that.
Sure.
I could go and create a dozen fax cover sheets and save them as lots of different files. If I then open up the DOTX, make a change and save it, it doesn't affect any existing instances that were created from the template. Now, that's the exact same with editing process templates.
Yep.
Now, there are command tools, so I can use things like...
WitAdmin.
WitAdmin, thank you.
Yep.
I was going to say WitD, that's old school
stuff.
That's
the old school.
Yeah, old school, don't do that.
It's all WitAdmin now.
So I could use command line tools or the process template editor, the graphic
Correct.
Tools, not for the exam, and I could go and then grab that new work item type and retrofit that into existing team
you
projects.
You absolutely can. And the other thing is each process template can have different customizations once mm-hmm. Each team project once you've created them. So that was a great question. That was Rich Visotsky. And Josh Wilcox mentions Verify. He just wants a shout out to the slash Verify, where you can do your upload with admin and do your upload with a whack Verify command, and it'll just check it for you against the server. It wouldn't have caught yours, however. Not your problem.
Josh is just, not living on the edge enough.
Now, Balas asks a fantastic question. How do you know which template version a TFS project is using? So I've created a team project called Team Project Foo. Mm-hmm. What process template did I use?
Ooh, now, there is something about the later versions that can answer that, Steve, but I'm not 100% sure.
It is a royal pain in the rump, and you got nothing until update 2, and I think it's update 2. Could be update 1. Mm. Now they finally tag it with some data, some metadata. It has always been the biggest pain in the behind, because what you would find is you'd go and look at it, and you go, okay, well, it's got a PBI, a product backlog item, therefore it's Scrum. Well, Scrum 1, Scrum 2, Scrum 2.1, Scrum 2.2.
Yeah.
Royally a pain. There's a CodePlex project that actually rips through and has all of the templates as base resources and does some comparisons, and it'll give you a how close is it? Is it 99% like this one? 98% like this one? Make a good guess. But up until recently, nothing you could do about that.
So, not necessarily nothing you could do about
okay.
it. So if you've done enough template customization over the years, you will have got absolutely sick and tired of this. So through your customization, you will have added additional fields. And those additional fields would allow you to then simply go and put in the name of the template and a custom version number.
Ooh,
now, you didn't need
yes.
to display those on the form. No one ever got to see them. But you could basically use them as a form of versioning. So that also then allowed you to use scripting. So I could say, iterate through all of my team projects, look for any that are currently on Anthony's version 3, and apply this update, please. So by putting in a couple of hidden fields there, which I've done for years, you could actually make that a lot more manageable in the future. So it's been something you've had to take responsibility for yourself.
So let's say you did that. You took some responsibility yourself, and mm-hmm. you uploaded Scrum version 2.0.
Yes.
You created a new process template, and now along comes Scrum version 2.2.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when I do update 2? Does it automatically update me to the new process template, or do I have to go in and make those changes myself?
So unfortunately, it won't automatically update you. You will need to go and make those changes yourself.
And to do so, you basically download the 2.2 process template and just use the work item, the WIT admin, and import the work items independently. There's a couple other things that might be changes, like the field mappings. With Scrum, you're not going to have to worry about field mappings to project because it just doesn't do that, very much of it. So you wouldn't have to worry there. But other than that, yep, you have to do it manually. And let's see. And let me, there was another one that was great. Oh, Greg, right back, Greg Williams, wrote back, and this is a blast from the past. He wrote, I'm importing TFS 2008 to TFS 2012, and it's about a 100 gig database. So a pretty small database. So it's not anything big. It's reasonably sized. And it's taking 24 hours to run the conversion. Is there a tool that I can use to identify what is taking so long and clean it up so that I can run it maybe faster next time? Like get the test attachment cleaner, anything you can think of?
That would be basically the only one I can think of. And that was a very, very not subtle hint that I appreciate. So I mean, I guess I mean you can take that question if you like.
I actually a 100 gig database should probably not take 24 hours to upload. I would be looking first at hardware constraints. So I'd actually be looking at performance counters first. So look and find the performance counters if you're running out of memory, if you're running out of disk space, if you're running out of network I/O. Those would be my primary ones I would look at first. Because 100 gigabytes really should only be taking you a few hours.
Yeah.
That's just a kind of a normal size database.
But answer the second part of that. I mean, you mentioned the test attachment cleanup tool. Did you want to take that as well?
No.
Nope.
Go ahead.
Okay. I don't want to take it either. Just kidding. So basically with that 100 gig, I mean, 100 gig really isn't that big comparatively for a TFS server. But before I was to start any form of migration or upgrade, and you know what? It's 2008. There's no test attachments.
Oh, there's no test attachments in there. You're right. Absolutely.
So cancel exactly where we were going to go with that.
Yep.
But if it was a 2010, so when test cases actually appeared and we could have test attachments on there. Sorry, Greg, this isn't going to help you at all. Prior to any form of move or upgrade or any of those sorts of things, you can run the test attachment cleanup. It's a power tool, and it goes in and you can set certain thresholds and values, and you can clean up a lot of unnecessary things like perhaps we did a lot of video recording for anyone that tuned in yesterday for the testing session jumpstart that Steve and I did. You know, the videos that get attached, they can take up a lot of space. Well, how long do you want to leave them around? So chances are couple of months, you can come along and you can, you know, strip those out of the database, and that can give you quite significant reductions in your SQL database size.
I want to do one more question because I think this is very critical.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to talk about the importance of field name uniqueness? This is Dave Bernison. This is really important when it comes to SSRS reports and more. Field name uniqueness. This. Do you want me to answer?
Please.
Field name uniqueness is one of those things that it drives me crazy. Because first of all, you have a ref name. A ref name like system dot or Northwest Cadence dot my foo field. You've got some kind of reference name, which a reference name has to be unique across the whole TPC, whole team project collection. But so do the friendly names. The friendly names have to be unique as well. Friendly names need to be unique. And the other names need to be unique. Now, here's the kicker. He talks about SSRS reports, those names. Something else. If I have two fields with the same name in two different project collections that have different data types, that's also going to cause me grief. So when you're doing reporting, there's also a reporting name attribute that you can also pass in. We haven't done it, but when you're defining the XML, you can pass in the reporting name and change that to something unique. And one of those will have to give.
Okay.
I've had this happen before. Well, we don't need to talk about it. Won't be on the exam. But, good. And Dave Bernison, hopefully that answers your question.
Excellent. Okay, well, let's go back to the deck for just a little while. In this next section, it's a very short section. Where are we? Creating work item queries. So this is something that I'm going to organize for Steve to demonstrate using a Keller VM in just a moment. What the study guide says we need to be aware of is how we can create work item queries. How do we define query folders and permissions? Applying query types. So the difference between a tree, a flat, or a direct link query. How we can add fields to a query. And creating a query using Team Explorer. So do you feel like a quick wrap around or a lap around some queries, Steve?
I do. I will happily do that. If you pop over to mine, I'll do some. And we got another question from Visionary One USA. I'm not sure if that's Jeff Smith or not. He's used that name before. So if it is Jeff, a quick shout out to you. But he asks, these new Kanban states, what can I do with the Kanban states? How do I reach into the warehouse or somewhere and grab those Kanban states and understand my state transitions?
So the mapping between states and metastates using our process files.
Mapping between states and metastates. And unfortunately, very difficult to capture. When I come back, however, there's somebody who has written what I think to be a very beautiful data warehouse adapter that actually connects and grabs any of those small state transitions in the Kanban board and maps them in more deeply. Was the Kanban board available prior to update one?
No, I thought it was an update one.
I think it's an update one, so we probably won't dive into that. If that's you, Jeff, feel free to just email me directly and I'll get you that link. Or if anyone else cares, I'll post the link directly in the Q&A.
Well, or if anyone cares, I'll post his email address. And you can all email
him.
True. That's perfectly good.
And you can always tweet me. You're welcome to email me for that. Or tweet me at Stephen Borg. I think my Twitter address is out here as well. All right, let's go back now and take a look at some work items. And I'm going to open up the work item area here. And in the work item area, we've got lots of different queries. And the things I want to show are creating new queries. And where would you prefer me to show it? Visual Studio? Or the web?
One of each.
Jinx. All right, here we go. My test cases. Let's go ahead in my queries. Let's create a new query. Right-click, new query. And for the new query, I may want to, I'll use the same example I did yesterday. Show me all of the bugs and the user stories. So if I want to know the work item type is user story, or the work item type is bug, then and assigned to equals at me. I want to throw these in. At project means that whatever project you run it in will show it to you. Assigned to is at me means whoever runs it, it'll always return their assigned to. And let's do date created. Or created date is greater than or equal to at today minus 7. That's going to say anything created after last week. Now the problem is this and an or here. What we really want to do is we want to highlight both of these and we want to group them. So we'll group that clause. So it'll be the project and then these two will be considered together. At that point, we can run it, and we have zero results found. Let's do something that was created less than or equal to today minus 7 and run that. What am I in? I'm in Tailspin Toys. There's no user stories and bugs that are assigned to me. I have a hard time believing that, but I'm going to get rid of the at me, delete those clauses, and save this as all user stories and bugs created more than 7 days ago. Save. Now let's run this one, and thank goodness they're all assigned to Julia. Oh, remember when we were doing bulk editing yesterday and I took all of those and I reassigned them to Julia? There we have it. No wonder none of my queries came up. So at this point, we've built a relatively simple query. And I've assigned it here to my queries, all user stories and bugs created here. I want to show you one more thing, however. If I right-click this I can add this to my favorites. Now it appears up here in my favorites. Mm-hmm. What happens if I take this and I drag it down to team favorites?
It's a great question.
Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? Drag it? I got it. I do want to show this. I created it in my queries. I can't drag it to team favorites. I have to bring it to shared queries first, then drag it up to team favorites. And this, I think, is smoking cool. We're now about to go out to the website. Prepare your depends. Fabricam Fiber. We're going to go over here to Tailspin Toys Web Access. And kaboom!
Look at that.
Look at that. Good work, adds Steve. Right there. All user stories and bugs created more than 7 days ago. It drops it in right here. Now, I'm going to go back to the Fabricam Fiber because it looks better here. But let's do the same thing only in the website version of it. To do so, we go back to, we can view right here, work items. And we can take a look at some of these favorites. Here are the team favorites. You already have those. And then we'll go into shared queries. And we'll add a new query right in here. Let's add a new shared query. And we'll call this, I don't know, what kind of crazy query should we do?
Oh, priority one bugs assigned to Brian.
Priority one bugs assigned to Brian. Okay. And we'll say the work item type is equal to, no we won't. You have big bugs. Do you want to expose big bugs as well? I think we should. So instead of saying work item type is bug and or work item type equals big bug, you could also say and work item type is in group Microsoft.bug category. Because I don't think you did it, but when you had your big bug, you could also add that to the bug category. Mm-hmm. So if I did that, that'll bring bugs and big bugs together. So, okay, what was it called? Priority one bugs. And priority? Oh, there it is. And priority is equal to one. And assigned to is equal to Brian Keller. Let's take a look. Let's do a quick save of that and run the query and see if we got anything. Nothing. Well, that's good. Brian has no priority one bugs assigned to him. That's, I guess, good news.
He's a diligent worker.
He's a diligent worker. I'm curious about two just as a quick run. Nope, still none.
There's okay. No bugs assigned to him.
Let's go bug and save it. And whoops, not save as. Save it. And now watch what we can do at this point. We'll scroll back down to priority one bugs. There's this nice little button here. This adds it to my favorites. Boom, it's added to my favorites. We can also right click it and add it to team favorites. And now it's also in team favorites. Mm-hmm. Voila. Let's now go back to Fabricam Fiber home. And we're going to find that, once again, we have the priority one bugs assigned to Brian. We got the big old goose egg right here. By the way, I love these. If you look at the all bugs, you can just click it, and it'll bring it here and show you the bugs. So that is a very quick overview of creating templates, as well as going creating queries, as well as adding those queries so that they appear on the front as those team favorites. And I showed you two ways to do it, one inside of Visual Studio and one inside the web.
All right, so back to my screen, and we're sort of in a monster time slot. So how about back to my screen, configuring client connectivity, basically how we can go and configure any of those clients and how we can configure Visual Studio for a proxy. You know what I'm going to do, Steve?
You can leave me the proxy because I have to talk the proxy later.
I'm going to leave you both. As you go and show the version control,
absolutely.
Just go and connect Team Explorer to Visual Studio, to TFS.
Fair enough. I'll happily do that.
Let's whiz through there. My best bets for this one, build topics can be found at that particular location there. With the customization, just do lots of practice on a non-production server and make sure you review those resources. But guys, I want to probably, let's take a 10-minute break there. It's been a monster session.
It has. It's been a very big session.
And let's come back to version control after the break.
And what I'd like you to do, if we can do one more poll, is it possible to do a quick poll? I'd like to know whether or not, can we do a poll?
As long as everyone promises to do the poll after that one.
As long as you promise to do the poll after this, there's a very quick poll, which I would just like to know, do people value us answering the questions as we're going? Or is it better to just try to type those questions in and not answer them verbally, which takes a little bit longer potentially? And I just would like to know if it's valuable for people, if they find that valuable. All right, let's take a break.